My radio stuck on CKUT. I don't know. But nah, fix it. CKUT, the number one radio station in Montreal. We give you the sun, the moon, the rain, the stars and the mountain. CKUT give you the word.
You are listening to From Embers, a weekly show on CFRC 101.9 FM about anarchist and anti-authoritarian ideas and practice. We are broadcasting from the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples on land that has come to be called Kingston, Ontario, Canada because of the thievery and brutality of the Canadian state and its empire-loving parents. From Embers is about fires, some real and some metaphorical. Fires started generations ago and tended to over the years. Little sparks all across this territory that we hope will grow, spread, and engulf the thieving state called Canada and the capitalist system that has plagued this land since the fur trade.
Tonight on From Embers, you'll hear my conversation with the author of a piece entitled Addressing Russian Propaganda, which you can find online at Perleski.org. That's P-R-A-L-E-S-K-I.org. This interview focuses more on some of the political background of what's going on with the Russian state and really urges people to consider the need to support people in Ukraine fighting off Russian invasion. Our conversation was recorded a few weeks ago now on March 29th, so my apologies for any details which are now out of date. I guess could you start by introducing yourself however you would like, or describing a bit in terms of your context, your surroundings, where you are, and...
I grew up in Russia. Like, I'm Russian. That's the first very important point, I guess, for this kind of interview right now. And so I left when I was a student, actually, like on the university. I mean, student in English, how it is, like university times. And then I kept the contact, and I was into, like, how to call it now, like anti-authoritarian anarchist, whatever, scene. And was living in the West, going to the West is like, well, what is the West for you in Canada? It might be a bit different to understand how Europe is, how people read it. So it's like, let's say everything from Poland to the West is West, and kind of that.
Sure,
so let's say so Western Europe, let's say. But then, about 10 years ago, like a bit less, I was actually, down with it. And I spent most of my time going around, like doing like different stuff, like, in Eastern Europe, like generalizing it this way.
In the context of this, of the recent, Russian military invasion of Ukraine, can you describe maybe what's going on either for you personally or people in your broader social networks?
When this war started, like in the first stage, was a big shock, I guess, for most of my environment as well, because I guess we didn't expect it on such scale, how it came, like so openly, so big, and like a big one. And I guess it's also the privilege of like, people like me who grew up without war and was actually only seeing it from some distance, and maybe also like some theological stuff, but like not wanting to believe in some things, or like not realizing it, like not being well prepared. It's like some, it sounds for you like quite crazy, even if you try to think about it. So, and yeah, I guess it was like also like a huge mobilization, let's say, that over last year wasn't part of any like well-organized groups or something. Let's say I'm a bit elder, I was like, have a lot of frustrations with that, and was living like personal life, let's say, with some, yeah, some connections to old friends. But, and then, yeah, it's coming and you're like, wow, shit happens, like it hits the fan, people, and you say, I guess, in a way, so you need to do something. I mean, I was in Kyiv actually just a week before the war started, by like some personal means, and so I just left before, and yeah, we was like joking about, yeah, not like quite sad jokes about like, yeah, the troops are closing, but yeah, for real, still thinking that, yeah, it will be some other like kind of escalation on like more the level of I don't know, saying like some media, whatever, like some tracks, but not really that the bombs will start falling just like just right after I left. So and that it will change the life like so crucial.
Can you describe a bit your context, like in terms of living under like the Russian state, so to speak, or its influence, or like Russia as like a military or colonial power, and sort of the like authoritarian regime that's currently in power?
Yeah, it's an interesting point because, you know, I grew up in the 90s where all this like authoritarian tendencies wasn't very much like visible for us. Like, I mean, grew up even like my teenage years and like early like 90s or 2000s. So just like I kind of seen it changing so much because let's say like in 90s and at school, I didn't get like even like state flag or like president was just alcoholics who was like Yeltsin. You may, I don't know if you know, but it's like a guy who nobody would like anyhow like respect or something. It's like it was just nothing real. Like people would watch like parliamentary shows from like TV and stuff like as a comedy or something. And yeah, it was very turbulent times in many ways, but generally spoken like ideologically from above, it was not really so much of a pressure. At least I haven't felt that. And then Putin came at power with a Chechen war, like second Chechen war they started, and like all this like what US got like with the how is like 9/11, yeah. So in Russia it was also like this terrorist attacks which have like very unclear nature. As for now, it's like some theories, very solid theories behind that actually the Secret Service was very much involved into organizing it, but whatever, it's it was like a mass mobilization against people in Chechnya, and a lot of like racist narratives and all this stuff was, now we have a new strong leadership, I guess. Back then was very young, like not really still understanding what is going on, and I guess the topic of this like colonial nature in a way, like maybe people wasn't, I cannot remember if people was using this word so much, I don't think so, to be honest, but generally like this agenda was kind of there. So also like in anarchist anti-authoritarian milieus, what was not really the case later, like 10 years later, maybe like late 2000s, it was not that much anywhere anymore there. So, and yeah, I don't know, it's like, you know, like this question, you should kind of compare it to something, yeah, because my main point is not that there is like authoritarian regime from above which is like enslaving people and making them some, I don't know, cruel monsters, but maybe in a way vice versa, that the people have something like in a society in Russia have something in it that makes exactly such a regime more suitable for So I don't mean, of course, like bullshit about like genetics and stuff. Please don't misunderstand it this way. I mean, of course, like some like historical narratives and what we was learning at school. Like later, I was realizing it more and more that even in this, being like Russian, what and being like growing up there, what it actually brings, and I guess this immigration experience was a big deal. To see how things changing from a side, like coming and going to visiting your family and friends and seeing like how things are changing, what was not maybe so much visible for people inside. So because you kind of hear like don't see it so much so well like from the close distance sometimes, I guess. And so yeah. And yeah, it changed like very much, like in, like just in practical way that let's say like mid 2000s and 2000s, like political actions. Sure, it was like quite some violence from the police, but generally spoken, political persecution in terms of like long-term sentences and stuff wasn't really there. So you would, I mean, I got like only a little bit of that, but the things that was like sentenced for, I don't know, $20, yeah, like US dollars. Now you can go for like several years in jail, you know, for the same. So it's kind of a big change, like of style, yeah. And I guess it's not that all the repressions and they was there. They was just not against people in Metropolis maybe so much. You know, I guess on the periphery it was definitely there. I mean, war was going on, and a lot of practices which people like which police and not only political police but usual police is using against people in jail or like in police stations. All this torture, they are not like falling from the sky. They was learning it in like war regions. They was learning it. They was torturing, I don't know, some Chechen people there. So then they was doing the same with like how to explain for proclaimed criminals or whatever, like you know people they outside of the this region. So it was like kind of it's very well described in some like literature on colonialism, you know, how it's like this kind of colonial boomerang. They call it, is it the word boomerang in English, right? Yeah, I'm not really sure. So yeah, I guess this kind of change of regime was going on with time, and maybe after 2012 or some 2012, like yeah, around that, after like this Bolotnaya case and stuff, it's like kind of crystallized more, and with Crimea like annexation and war with Ukraine 2014 and like military invasion there. It was also like this mass mobilization, which like was also showing that the ideology which was developed, like created, like recreated, like in 2000s, that it became more of like actual thing of the state. Because I guess when Putin came at power and it was like starting to change like his he in person his team whatever how you call it, like they was changing the political life like in the country, like how it's organized, like centralizing it, like gaining more power and eliminating enemies and like changing political field. I don't think they was so much into ideology actually. They was like trying different ones. I mean, 2004 there was like a first Maidan movement in Ukraine. And government changed, so they in Russia like really got fear that it might change their positions too. And I guess they this generation of old people from security service and so on, they really didn't got like a well education in social sciences and their understanding of societies around them and their own society is very rigid, like very simplistic. And I guess they really believe in like this conspiracy theories and stuff like that somebody from above is like influencing people, and so they need to be in control somehow. So they started to try to control like the streets in some way, like creating some political parties. And I guess it wasn't like intentionally that they created this thing, like created, adopted this like red brown stuff, like this mixture of like Stalinism and old, even like monarchism, let's say, and like right wing elements. I guess it was more of like trial and error that it just worked better. And also that the people they got to work for them was like mostly good in that and coming mostly from that corner. So it's why I guess it's changed in this way.
I wanted to ask you to describe sort of the idea of anti-fascism in Russia, or how that is sort of used by the state, or even sort of like also the presence of more like apolitical anti-fascism that's not necessarily like a anti-authoritarian or like resistance thing, but more like a narrative used to justify and motivate the Putin regime's forces, I guess. Like, yeah, I wanted to ask you to talk about or describe fascism and the idea of anti-fascism in the context of Russia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what is maybe hard to understand that it's like state ideology, first of all, that the relation to the Second World War and particular how people call it, it's like Great Fatherland War in Russia. It's maybe the main historical narrative at all. So, you know, in 90s, not in only 90s actually, but in 90s it was very visible that the state and like similar institutions, they was like desperately looking for like some tradition they can appeal to, you know, and like maybe to mobilize people and stuff. And the story of the Second World War was quite well suited for, because it gave the opportunity to mobilize people without any appeal to any values or something, you know, because it's absolutely empty. It's like the main thing is like to oppose the invaders, you know, the idea of the war, Second World War, or like it's seen more in the tradition of invasion, like mostly Western invasion. It started in 30s already, like late 30s, and maybe like during the Second World War it was like crystallized more like in Stalin times. So that actually the Russian state like was always attacked, like some invaders was coming like from Teutons, it's like German kind of thing, like in 13th century, and then Alexander Nevsky was like fighting that, or like Polish people was like taking Moscow in the beginning of 17th century and then was fought back, or like Napoleon was coming. And actually war with Napoleon, like it was like the first Fatherland War, like just the Fatherland War, you know, the Second World War is a Great Fatherland War. War with Napoleon is a usual like Fatherland War. It was also one of the main narratives in 19th century. And it was also times when the Russian nation was built, let's say like, when it was like fulfilled, like finished, or like if you can say at all that this process is finishing anytime in history. So the main narratives was like that the invaders are coming, the invaders like facing not just like some political group or like some particular party in the government or something, but they're facing like the whole Russian nation, like the whole Russian like people, you know. So the people are uniting around some idea, or like some idea of like land or something, and fighting back and then destroy this threat. Yeah. And so for the Second World War, for the Great Fatherland War, it's crystallized in the idea that the invaders are like essential threat, not only for Russia, but like for the whole world. Yeah. It's like Nazism, like Nazis, yeah, German Nazis. They're like the big threat, without any idea actually what exactly is the threat, you know. It's just like they are just evil, yeah, they just want to destroy everything you love, whatever, but what exactly, it's like not clear. They're just coming and destroying. So we have to be united, and united in around a leader in the end, you know, like how it was like in Stalinism, or, you know, like around the leader, or around at least like the leading party or the state, the idea of state. So because historically seen, like Second World War in the territories of ex-Soviet Union, now it was like such a multitude of different like armed groups, partisans, and then like some different forces of like state, nation, this, that, collaborants, and so on. And the narrative which is actually shared by the society is that there's like only two sides. Yeah, Nazi Germany and the good guys. So ours, like Red Army, or like however people call it. So, and in this like worldview, anti-fascism is not anyhow connected to any like values. You know, it's like actually not really clear like how you distinguish between fascist and not fascist. It's just an enemy, just like just everything evil, you know, like being fascist. Because like in Soviet Union and later in Russia, like this theories of what is fascism and stuff, like, wasn't really developed. So, and so this kind of way of seeing that makes it very easy to feel this story with whatever particular groups, you know. And so it's more about symbolic, maybe, you know, like what is easier to see. Yeah, if somebody have a like swastika, it's a fascist. If not, if like red star or something, that's anti-fascist or something like that. And then even more that Russian is like per se essentially anti-fascist. Yeah, and everybody who is against Russians is a fascist then. Yeah. And already before the Second World War, and then during and after, the central government of Russia like adopted like this kind of Russian chauvinism, or like how you would call it back then, like playing with that and like playing using. So, and there was also resistance to it. Yeah. So there was like occupied territories, like the new ones in the West, for example, not only in the West, but also there. So there was like mass ethnical like deportations, which was amount of casualties, or like amount of like people dying during that. You can call cleansings, or like how you call it, like ethical cleansings or something. Yeah. So repressions, let's say. So yeah, the central state narratives was calling these people who was opposing it also like fascists, yeah, and then was using this idea of like Nazi collaborators, because at some point like Nazis was using some nationalist forces as a collaborator units during the war. Like, I mean, interesting point about that, it's like the Russians was actually the biggest one, like if you would see like the amount of like how big this units was, yeah, but nobody's talking about that. People only talking about like so-called like traitors, you know, traitor nations, like they call it like completely like traitor nations, and these are like the most unloyal ones in the end, yeah, like people who was not loyal enough and was resisting. Yeah, it's like the whole like periphery mostly of Soviet Union is full of such stories, yeah, like how the central government was oppressing the resistance and like repressing people. So this and this repressions would be calling like the anti-fascist one in the end, you know.
Ясно же, красно, да, да.
You're listening to From Embers, airing first on CFRC 101.9 FM.
We're also a proud member of the Channel Zero Anarchist Podcast Network. We'll get right back to my interview with a guest speaking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine. But first, here's a jingle from another Channel Zero show.
Listening to Dissident Island Radio.
Live every first and third Friday of the month at 9 p.m. GMT.
Check out www.dissidentisland.org for downloads and more.
And also, like this, particularly like this propaganda about traitors, not just the people as traitors, but like collective guilt of several nations. Like, for example, how it was like with Ukrainians and like their movements, yeah, which is now Russia is like calling to it a lot. It's like that the figure of Ukrainian as such, like during like, I don't know, 19th century and even before, already was connected with the idea of threat, like in Russian nationalism, like on the very early stages. A bit like simplistic and speculative, yeah, to say, when Russian nation was built, like modernization came like in the 18th century with Peter the Great and later, like started maybe even before. There are like different ways to define your own nation, yeah, through the othering. It's like very familiar, like you have like others, yeah, let's say like people who are not white, who have like other race, or like who are definitely like others, yeah. It's like for Russia it would be like people in Central Asia, native people, or like people from Caucasus and so on. But with other Slavic folks, yeah, like Belarus or Ukraine, it's different. So it's not like they are not others. Russians refuse the right to exist to them. So it's like the way of like they would be like kind of somehow broken Russians, you know, somehow polluted by the West or something, yeah. So like something invented and so traitors, yeah. So that they was like polluted by the West and they are not willing to be Russians, yeah. They kind of seen and they treat is that they not accepting. Not just the rule of Russian like Tsar or like central government, but they are not thankful enough that just to dissolve in the body of the Russian nation. Yeah. So yeah. In this way, it's like even to declare I'm Ukrainian, I'm from Belarus. It's already a threat. Yeah. It's already something which cannot happen, and it's why now Russia is like what they're calling Nazism now, yeah? It's actually the very idea of independence, the very idea of being not loyal to the central government is actually fascism for them, you know? Of course, they're also using like these facts of collaboration history of some like groups during the Second World War. It's like easy to find. You can find like everybody there, you know? It's like Russians, whoever. So it's not a big deal to do. So, but the way is like what you will highlight and how you will use it in a modern propaganda. That's the point, yeah. So, and then it's like a big denial of even like existence of Ukraine. They're saying Ukraine was created by Lenin or Ukraine was created by Austrian-Hungarian bureaucrats or whatever. You know, they will just. Not even like kind of see it as an enemy. They will see it like as a puppet of the West or something, you know? It's like there is no such thing, you know, as Ukrainian. And so the idea of this denazification for Putin now, it's like they see it as liberation, you know, from how it is like Yoko, like from the foreign rule or something, yeah, that people should be like very thankful for, you know, that you kind of make them good again, you know. They was like suffering under, I don't know, Western rule or something, and now Russians will come and we will liberate them, you know. That's the idea of like how this propaganda ideologically works, you know, like what they trying to sell.
Yeah, I totally understand, like, how that would be awful and bad to be experiencing as someone who lives in Ukraine and sees like a necessity to fight against the Russian invasion. What, like, do you see a position or a way to do that or to support that that doesn't depend on supporting the Ukrainian state or participating in a specifically Ukrainian nationalism? Like, is there another sort of way that people can think about that struggle? And does that, is that a current that exists on the ground that you know of also?
Yeah, I mean, the thing is right now that it's not such, there is no such a luxury of like choosing between like ideologically right or not so much, like, you know, like what do you like so much. It's like, it's a question of survival. So I'm not in a position to judge people for whatever so choices. And I don't see like my position is like people first should survive, and I want to support them in that. And then we'll be like seeing like, well, what is going on, you know? And so I guess what is like, with anarchists, it's like, an anarchist myself, you know, it's like, the thing is like that, yeah, don't support the state. Okay, like, how far you will go with not supporting the state? Yeah, it's always the question. Yeah, we are like using, I don't know, like, I don't know, water supply, like in my house is like built by the state, you know, I mean, this house not, but like, whatever, like how far you will go, yeah? Of supporting, not supporting the state. What is more interesting for you? Being like having like puristic view on to show off among your like small circle, or like literally like achieving something, yeah. So and like achieving something in a like in a way of like how society is changing, or like what kind of like. Or like not changing, or like maybe just surviving in a way, yeah. Like we have now the situation where you have like Russia, which is like politically a black hole. There is like nothing there. It's like everything which reached this like gravity disappears. That's it. Like you could see it like when we're coming back to Ukraine, like when Crimea was annexed, people who was politically active needed to escape. That's only the option. I mean, barely. Yeah, it's like. At least to say that's not comparable how much you can do in Ukraine, like this kind of like more like bourgeois democracy, whatever society, how you call it, or like in Russia, which is like getting more and more authoritarian, and now you might call it fascist. So there is definitely a difference for opportunities in those different societies. So, and now it's connected to extinction, it's connected to the fact that Russian army is now using the tactics, which means like completely destroying, like not just like ideologically something, no, just fucking with people, like really literally like bombing people away, like completely, like the cities, the houses, the like killing like thousands, like thousands and ten thousands of people, you know, it doesn't matter whom. It's a part of the tactics, like military tactics. So and the ideology behind it is quite scary. I mean, they was first talking about denazification of like some political parties or whatever. Now they like maybe about a week, 2 weeks ago, like not only some like radicals from internet, but like people on the like state TV and so on, they started to talk about, look, Ukrainians are refusing to accept our rule. They're strange. It looks like that all of them are Nazis. So, and what they are doing now, for example, with people who they, we don't have like, we, who they kidnap, or I don't know how, maybe like let them go, like from Mariupol to Russia, they kind of start in like this, how it is in English correct, called like filtration camps, concentration camps, where they denazificate these people first and then deport them somewhere deep in Russia, or like, it's not really, we don't have like that much facts to describe it very like well, but it's definitely something, I don't like these big words usually, but it's a fucking genocide, like what is going on. And then, you know, and then now talking about like to support this or to support that, it's like great actually if we would have this opportunity so well. And there are initiatives who are like more horizontal, and actually the most initiatives, like Ukrainian state is not that strong to organize everything. It was not in any sense, not in sense of military, not in sense of bureaucracy and so on. So it does rely on like self-organized initiatives as well. So so there is not just like a vertical top-down organizing there. Yeah, the most of things, I mean, like our comrades now and like friends, how they organize, it's like horizontal from people to people, you know. And in this way, there are like plenty of opportunities to support. Yeah. So, and also, yeah, maybe not everybody's waving like circle A, yeah. But what is happening, I would call it very close to what anarchists call like anarchism in terms of organizing and like real on the ground, yeah. Like mutual aid, I mean, what is going on, a lot. So, and the thing about like nationalism and like nationalist mobilizations and stuff, so you cannot avoid to have it like in a war and in our century, so in this time. So I don't think I'm the right person to to question too much about, you know. I don't see myself in the position, like, you know, to judge and to make like some fancy analysis on that right now. I guess we should ask people in Ukraine about
it. Sure. Yeah.
I guess I can speak for Russia, and I can talk more about like Russia. What the fuck is that? I'm sorry for language.
I mean, so. I'm glad. I think that's an important perspective to share, honestly, because it's, you know, speaking to people in the West who are like living under Western imperialism and NATO, et cetera, et cetera. It's like, it is a choice in a sense of like, oh, how do you want to talk about this struggle, or how do you want to support it or encourage other people to support it? And, you know, I mean, I personally do think that people who are suffering under this invasion and or suffering under living under this regime deserve our support, like, you know, just ordinary people. They're not it's not the state or something. And it, what am I trying to say? Yeah, it's just that like I think critical solidarity is important, but I think it's, I agree that it's sometimes like easier to fall back into sort of purist apathy or something, and I don't think that's good.
No, sure. So I mean, it's a very comfortable position, you know, like to be so like judgy. And then the problem of this position is that people are following sometimes like just somebody who is like who is just presenting what people want to see, you know, like I don't know if I'm clear. So it's like you want somebody who is waving circle A, people will wave circle A. Yeah.
So. Yeah, for sure.
I don't know if there are like doubts of supporting now people in Ukraine. I don't know how to talk like forward, like to touch people, like doubts in terms of like really okay, just die, because I'm not really completely sure if I will support your initiatives of buying like some medical supply, or like I don't know, like collecting money for another car to drive like refugees from the border. Maybe it will somehow support the nationalism. So just fuck off. I mean. What we are talking about, you know, like really in this case, I just don't know. This kind of discussions are like disgusting. I guess there are times for discussions. There are times for when it's maybe too late. I mean, it's more about people with my background. Even I'm not living in Russia for ages, still I have like some responsibility for what happened. Like, I mean, yeah, I was like, I told you, like, and you actually know that I'm not just wasn't supporting the state, but I tried to do something like against this ideology, like propaganda and stuff, but not enough. So it's absolutely clear. And that's also the point now. So that it's a point to think about that. Like, well, what actually was a fail? Like, what was it? What should be done, like, and what we can done now, do now. So, and I guess, so yeah. And the part of this dynamics of, looking from the center to the periphery in this very colonial way of, like, judging people, like, in a way of, like, using the frames you created yourself for them. So, and then just, like, picking the position, so, like, picking something which suits your own analysis, like, in the center, like, just to feed up your own, I don't know, theories or like everyday just subcultural like attitudes, life, you know, to just using like some references, how it happens like with solidarity movements a lot. I don't know if you understand what I mean. So.
I think so.
Yeah, so I guess people will understand. So that's definitely not solidarity, how I wouldn't call it solidarity, to be honest. Something else, sure, but... And it doesn't mean that people are evil doing that. I mean, the intentions are great, and the problem is, like, the ways it's canalizing, like, maybe even some empathy and some, like, willing to make something good. It's like... So, yeah. And, yeah, critical solidarity, sure, absolutely. But to have, like, critical solidarity, first you need to have a very good connections to people, and it's not something you create, like, just in a few seconds, you know? Like, it's not that you're just calling the hotline of, like, help, and then, like, yeah, you help. No, it's like you need to have the contact between movements, like solidarity ones, for sure. So, but, yeah, so it's actually maybe the point as well. To do so, especially yeah. Right now, it's like to reduce people in Ukraine to some victims. It's absolutely bullshit. Like people showing such a like the will and to resist and to like to like we should learn. I mean, it's not something like that. Some cool guy somewhere in the West would be like. Now like teaching people no come on, just take a look, like some I don't know, some peasant villagers from Ukraine will maybe teach you something, like me too. So how to self-organize, like, well, you know, under these circumstances, I guess it's like the approach should be a bit different. So
what would you hope to see in that regard, or like in terms of people either offering meaningful support or trying to build connections with people and movements, what do you think would help people do that?
Yeah, I mean, right now it's maybe not a good time for big discussions with people on the ground. Yeah, it's like something, yeah, people are, let's say, busy. Yeah. So I guess it's clear. So, but yeah, to establish like connections and support, that's yeah. I guess it's right now it's quite easy. It's just like people need resources. People need Yeah, resources in the first line. I mean, there are some initiatives you might be linking later. So it's actually quite a lot. You could see, like, in Europe, for example, how people organize in helping refugees, or, like, people organizing, like, to deliver some, like, material resources, not just money, but also, like, some stuff which is now complicated to get, like, in Ukraine itself, and, like, delivering it. And, like, people going there to do stuff as well. So it's, like, I don't know, maybe It's somehow it's so obvious, and somehow maybe yeah, so much questions are rising still. I don't know. Maybe you should be more precise. But...
That makes sense. Because yeah, in a sense, it is kind of obvious. But I guess I feel motivated by like sort of identifying the obstacles to people doing that. Like, which I think one of them is this sort of like kind of purist attitude. But maybe that's not the only obstacle. I think maybe also sometimes another obstacle is like, which you kind of spoke about earlier, is like some of the confusion around like who is a fascist and who is like not a fascist and what is, you know, like people have this like, I think it comes from a good place, like this like strong desire to not help far right or fascist movements grow because it means a lot of violence and misery for many, many people in the world. Like, I respect that. But I think there is a lot of like confusion and disinformation and stuff about different actors in these conflicts. So even, you know, talking about that like state narrative of anti-fascism and whatever is like, I think helpful.
I guess it's like this identity politics is just like not really helpful. It's because, you know, if somebody calls themselves anti-fascist or fascist, even sometimes, like, I mean, fascist is maybe a less fashionable word right now, but it doesn't really mean anything. It's just a word, guys. I mean, first, clarify for yourself, what do you mean with anti-fascism? What exactly do you mean? Or like fascism? So when you clarify it for yourself, what you exactly you mean to for the fascism, you know, like with fascism, what is that? What are like particularly, like, what is that? Like, if you have, I don't know, racist attitude, it's clearly more clear, yeah? Or like homophobia, it's like more clear. Okay, somebody's homophobic, like, okay, I don't want to work with them. All right, or not all right. So, you know, more precise. And then if you have it like for yourself, then maybe you will be checking it better. Like, you know, how many fascists you need in a group to consider it a fascist group, you know, like, is it like, if in the army of, I don't know, Canada, like, let's say like a cell or like in the police, like, yeah, like three Nazis, is the whole police or like whole unit Nazi or not, you know, and so on, you know, just like be more precise for yourself maybe, you know, and be like more consequent with this like judgments, you know. I guess the big problem is that people don't know themselves what they mean, and anarchists, this ones, leftists, whatever, what exactly do you mean, like, for yourself first of all, you know? Then you, it maybe will be more clear, like, on the other side of the globe, you know, what do you mean? Because then don't follow the symbols like that much, don't follow the words, which might mean something completely different. It's exactly the point with Russia. It was like very visible after 2014 when, like, in Western Europe, like all these groups, not only Stalinist, but the groups who see like red flags and Hamanzikel and so on as something fashionable. They were seeing like literally Nazis from Russia. Like, there was such groups like on the Russian side who was also waving these flags because they understand it different. They understand it as a sign for a big, strong empire and like national interest, blah blah blah, very much like computes very well with their like ideology of I don't know, like the other parts of like leadership, like nationalism, racism, homophobia, and so on, you know, like the things which are easier to localize, let's say, as ideology, yeah, in a particular group or in a particular like people, yeah? And then you also might be like more precise of understanding, okay, like if you have like, I mean, all this like think about like looking for fascist or anti-fascist everywhere and like defining everything along like this lines is a trap, I would say, like especially if it's like mostly symbolic thing. So, you know, it's like very identitary trap, and it might work very well for like your local context because you know it. You know who is a fascist. I mean, just remember, I don't know if you do, like 2000s when autonomous nation disappeared in Europe. Yeah, people were so confused. Like, some Nazis or not Nazis, or who is that? They wear the same clothes, use the same symbolics, play the same music, go to the same gigs, like whatever, making hip hop and stuff. Like old school boneheads was gone. You know, like this 90s style, like 80s style, where it was clear. Okay, you see like Nazi bone, like Nazi skinhead, Nazi bonehead, very clear, like people showing, how's in English, Zikai, like Hitler Bruce, whatever. Yeah, and where they're like into Hitler and stuff. Whoops, it changed. And then people are so disoriented. Like the whole movements, like in, I don't know, some ecological groups and stuff, like environmentalists, yeah, and so on. They was like just hijacked by right-wingers because people was not able to identify them because they was looking only for symbols and stuff, yeah. So in this case, it's playing into hands of Russia for sure, because sure, Russia defeated fascism, yeah? It's a fucking state ideology there, yeah? And what was, what is the idea behind it right now, yeah? So, I mean, it's quite obvious right now for everybody, yeah? I mean, at least like in the regions here. So it's quite clear, yeah? So, but it seems to be not so clear even in Western Europe still, so.
I guess I'd heard reports about like people fleeing Ukraine, maybe specifically from Mariupol, ending up in Russia, or that some of these like so-called like humanitarian corridors were leading to Russia, which was maybe not actually very safe or whatever, and that some people are now being held in camps. Can you maybe describe that situation or talk about what's happening there?
Yeah, I guess the information is quite limited on that purpose. There are like official reports from like Ukrainian governmental organizations that they consider it kidnapping, or like, I guess, yeah, correct word, like kidnapping of Ukrainian citizens to Russia. And yeah, Russia is definitely not following this kind of thing with like humanitarian corridors. They still shooting on people. There are like enough proofs on that. So and yeah, from Mariupol, it's very close to Russia, and it's also very close to occupied territories in the eastern Ukraine. So yeah, looks like they put the people there, are like some evidences which I can believe very easily, and there is like proofs and stuff that yeah, they put people in this like concentration of filtration camps, like people disappearing. They are first checking like if like loyalty or like whatever they consider not a threat for Russian state or like some institutions. So if you are like relative of somebody who's in the army or like whatever, you know, like checking your like phones and like social networks and stuff. It's definitely not how refugees are coming and like invited and stuff. And then there are like reports about that they make proposals, you can't really say no, to go to work to some like very remote regions, for example, and that they kind of disperse people as well, and so on. I might believe that some people might be better going to Russia than to die, so it's absolutely possible, but yeah, it's like there should be a lot of investigations on that, like done, which is now, I guess, due to situation, not so easy to do. So we should definitely keep an eye on it. And the politics, what like Russia is doing, it seems to be, they it's not only Mariupol, you know, there was like some cities also on the like borders of like closer to Kharkiv and in Donbass region, which I erased completely. Like they are doing very similar stuff like in Chernihiv as well, which is like a different region. So yeah, they kind of destroying, not from very day first, they wasn't only aiming on like military objects. They was like, but after some point when it was clear that there is some resistance, they start to erase like, yeah, I repeated it many times. Yeah, they just erase like civil areas. And this camps and so on, it's like definitely can be a part of that. I mean, you should understand that a lot of troops, which they actually accumulated and who was invading Ukraine, wasn't like a usual army, let's say. It was more like a police. you know, because I guess they was mostly expecting that there will be no military resistance, so they will just take the territory, and the and what they will do is like more or less like what they're doing in Russia, like was controlling the population, you know, not having an actual military fight. So, and yeah, this, people are doing it all the time. So, and they have like some experience with that. So,
are there specific things that I haven't asked you about yet, but that you feel are important to mention or that you specifically wanted to highlight?
I want to add one thing. As a person who was born in Russia and was raised as a Russian, that Russia, the state, as a cultural reference, as a national project, is a threat for everything I love, everything I stand for, and it should perish. It should never happen again. And it should be very clear that Russia never again.
The Community Media Advocacy Center is hosting a series of consultative events titled Building an Anti-Racism Strategy for Canadian Broadcasting. Made possible with support from the Anti-Racism Action Program at Canadian Heritage, these important and timely events will help confront barriers experienced by Black, Indigenous, and people of color in the media.
Events will be hosted in Montreal, Vancouver, Halifax, Calgary, and Winnipeg, culminating in a national conference to be held at Carleton University in Ottawa. These events will host presentations and open forums to develop an anti-racism strategy that will reduce barriers to participation in media and broadcasting policymaking for racialized Canadians.
Register for free to join the event in person at UQAM on Saturday, April the 30th. Presentations start at 10 a.m.
Complete details are online at www.antiracism.media.
This is a CKUT co-presentation.
Being vaccinated against COVID-19 doesn't protect you from this. Or this.
Mom, what's for dinner?
Not this. This.
And it's looking like rain, rain, and more rain for this weekend.
This. Or even this.
Your call is important to us. Please hold.
But being vaccinated does protect you from the virus. Vaccination is still your best form of protection. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
Radio with Widget and my man Pro V.
All the way live from university.
Damn, Montreal. On CKUT. Nobody do it better, dog.
90.3 FM.
CKUT and the place to be from the bottom to the TOP.
This program is uncut. It contains strong language and some adult situations. Discretion is advised.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. All the way live radio, CKUT, 90.3 FM, every single Wednesday from 3 to 5. This is Pro V. Thank you very much for tuning in. Today's show is going to be an interview with Montreal legend DJ Choice. So you might know DJ Choice from Dubmatic. You might know DJ Choice from Zero Tolerance. You might know him as a DJ. You might know him from the work he did with Shades of Culture, as a DJ, as a producer. He's got about a good, 20 years of history that we could not cover in 2 hours of talking. So what we're gonna do is like a part one and part two. This week is part one, next week will be part two. And so this week we're gonna be getting into